Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Meeting Committee meeting to order. Please silence your cell phones. The time is 1:45 on Wednesday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, 2024. Today I'm joined by Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, and myself, Senator Olson, Senator Co-Chairman Hoffman will be by shortly. He's away on other state business. I'd like to go ahead and say that we're going to put SB 132 by Senator Bishop on to hear this afternoon. It's the educational head tax. This is his first hearing. Senator Bishop will go and introduce the bill. Either you want to choose your spot or you want to go back there. It's fine.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Got a quorum and I'll go to the
Let's go.
Head of the table and bring my trusty staff.
Okay. Senator Bishop, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation on this very important bill that you put forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Click Bishop, Senator for District R. And if it was a state, it would be the third largest state in the union. And part of it's your old district, Chairman Olson. So
thank you.
With that, I will get started and introduce the bill before us. So when it comes to infrastructure, especially in education, the legislature has a constitutional responsibility under Article 7, Section 1, to provide quality and public education for Alaska's children. You know, and I came from the private sector before I came to Juneau as Commissioner of Labor many years ago, and in the construction industry, and I'm sure you could relate to it as an air carrier yourself, deferred maintenance is a liability in the private sector. There's not anybody at this table that doesn't understand that, because we've been talking about deferred maintenance here forever, and our deferred maintenance in education on our major maintenance list and our school construction list is monumental. And this year alone, you know, the major maintenance list, all funds, it's about $330 million if we were going to clean up the list. Our school construction list is $395 million. This bill would be a small step, but the right step forward, to start whittling away at this list. And I think it's very important, as we've been having this education conversation around the building. We've all had the same people in our rooms. I know, speaking from the 10 school districts I represent, people are having to cut maintenance staff hours in half to maintain teachers in the classroom. They're having to take money away from classrooms to fix leaky roofs, etc. And you understand that. I know you do. Example in post-secondary education, the university, they have a deferred maintenance list of $1.45 billion. And the total number for educational facilities between these three lists totals $2.18 billion. So we are faced with our jobs to step up to the plate, and it's a tough job. We all know what the status of our finances are here at the table better than anybody. So this bill, it's not a new idea. It was so good that the territorial legislature enacted it. And I went to work out of high school, and my first employer, Joe Jakovich, he ran a rigging and cable shop in Fairbanks. In my first paycheck, he set me down and went through my list of deductions. And he said, "Kid, this $5 deduction here on this education head tax, that goes to your school. to pay for your education. $5. Then when it was last raised, it was 10 before it was taken off the books. So I've had this bill introduced in 2015, 2017, 2019, 2023. It was repealed in 1980. Since then, it has been introduced 15 times, not counting our four attempts, by seven Republican legislators, seven Democrat legislators, and one independent governor, Walter J. Hickel. And as your former commissioner of labor, and I eat, breathe, and sleep this Trends magazine, and you've heard me over the years at the table talk about I want to make sure I get the right word. Excellent doesn't do it justice. There's got to be a better word, but my Cat Skinner vocabulary can't think of it today. But we have the best research and analysis division, I think, of any state in the union. And when Trends puts out an article, I used to say, and when Neil Fried wrote it, and those people down there, it was like E.F. Hutton. People listen to the data. This month's Trends magazine talks about non-resident employment. Be that as it may, it's the data. 21% or so of 2022's data, we're still in that 20 to 21% non-resident wages. It's just a fact. It's not a dig. It's just a fact. But my point is, that results in about $3 billion leaving this state. $3 billion leaves the state. And I can't guarantee with 100% accuracy, but I would be safe to say that they are being taxed on these Alaska wages back in their states, going to their schools in some form or fashion. Now, with that being said, the last time I presented this bill, it was $2.2 billion. Now it's up to $3 billion in non-resident wages. And I'm not just picking on them. This bill encompasses everybody in the state, right? It's a one-time increment coming out of your check. And and if you go to a different employer within your employment year, you know, it comes out again, but you get a remittance at the end of the year, and that'll be talked about at some point at the chair's prerogative when we talk about fiscal notes. But we are looking at a renaissance on the North Slope where we've got 8 good years in front of us. These wages are going to continue to creep up, both for non-residents and residents. That's a good thing, right? We've got a renaissance going on in the North Slope. And bigger than that, that's a great story. But the other story is the exploration work that is happening on the North Slope right now. Alaska should feel pretty good. We should feel pretty good here at this table of where we're headed going forward. So with that being said, I think you get the picture, and I'm just speaking from the heart, and I appreciate the notes, John, but there you go. I went off script.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions from the bill sponsored by members of the committee? If not, we'll have the details being put together by John Bitney, Senator Bishop's staffer. If you'd like, go and identify yourself for the record and fill in the details.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Bitney. I'm staff to Senator Bishop to assist him and the committee here with Senate Bill 132. Just to give a quick synopsis, Senate Bill 132 proposes to revive the repealed head tax, as the senator said, that was repealed in 1980. It would collect $30 from each person employed in the state, whether they're employed or self-employed. The tax would be withheld from the employee's first paycheck within each calendar year. And it would be deductible, is my understanding, from the individual's federal income tax return. According to the fiscal notes, the bill is expected to bring in about $14 million a year. And I know we can talk about that, Mr. Chairman, at your prerogative when we get to the notes. And there's language in the bill that marks the disposition of the funds for the Educational Facilities Maintenance and Construction Fund. That fund is a fund within the general fund that is available for both school construction, maintenance, and also facilities of the University of Alaska. The Senator touched upon the most recent statistics from the Department of Labor, and I wanted to express my appreciation for their help in putting these numbers together. And I know they are available here in the room, as well as representatives from the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I would just like to just give a summation, sectional analysis of the bill.
Without objection, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. Section 1 amends the Department of Labor's Title 23 to allow them to work with the Department of Revenue in the collection of the tax. And that's because the unemployment insurance division at the Department of Labor currently collects the unemployment security tax. So there exists their data and tax collection expertise that's in place now that could hopefully be a relationship that could help in the getting this off the ground and moving forward. Again, that's Section 1. Section 2 amends Title 43 to add a new Chapter 45 that authorizes the Department of Revenue to collect the $30 tax on wages and net earnings from those who are self-employed for both resident and non-resident. It also then requires employers to withhold the tax from the employee's first paycheck of the calendar year. Any failure to submit the tax results in civil penalties imposed on the employer in an amount up to five times the tax due. The Department of Revenue then is authorized to adopt regulations regarding the payment and the maintenance of the tax records, and they shall coordinate again with the Department of Labor, as we discussed in Section 1. That then adds a 45031, which requires self-employed individuals to remit the tax due in accordance with regulations that are adopted by the department. Again, this is for the self-employed. It then goes on to outline the processes for refunding overpayments. So if someone works a couple of jobs or more in a given year, and if they get dinged the $30, that there is a process for them to go and so that they don't overpay, they can get the overpayment amount back from the department. It then requires any person to report to the Department of Revenue on payments to a self-employed individual. So if you're paying, for example, a commercial fisherman paying crew, and if they get, you know, 1099 them for the payments that they make, they're required to report. There is then language in the bill that describes the remittance of the revenue to the Education Facilities Fund, which I'll try to see if I can pull up the language there. We just described that earlier. Again, as you can see, this is on the screen here. This is the fund that we would propose that the tax revenue go into to, if you will, put sort of a moral fence around it for the legislature to designate the money towards school maintenance, construction, and facilities of the University of Alaska. There is also a definition of terms. Section then goes on to Section 3 of the bill is uncodified law pertaining to the adoption, implementation of regulations to put this in place. Section 4 provides an immediate effective date for Section 3, which would relate to the adoption of the regulations so that the departments can get underway as soon as the bill is enacted. And then last, Section 5 has an effective date of January 1, 2024, Mr. Chairman. And so obviously if the that's behind us at this point, so that may be something that needs to be addressed if in the event there may be a change or this bill advances forward.
Sure. Any further questions by members of the committee? For Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Bishop. Why was the head tax repealed in 1980?
I can't say. I was out working and I wasn't in the building, but if I was to take a leap of faith, I would say it's probably around the same time that they were looking at repealing the income tax and Prudhoe Base online, and we're increasing production on the North Slope, and there was at that time only 400,000 and change of Alaskans in the state, not 715 like we have today, and with the money that was coming in the building, and if the senior senator from Bethel was here, we'd ask him to confirm this, but I think the people thought that we had plenty of money coming in, and it was one of the taxes to repeal.
As I remember, the atmosphere was the happy days are here again with the $900 million leases that were up on the North Slope, that we don't need to have all these taxes. And I think it was ill-advised at the time to go ahead and do away with them. They could have put them on hold and it wouldn't be so hard to implement them or have a trigger point where they could be put back into place again. Any other further questions by members of the committee? Senator Keel.
Detail question first, and maybe Mr. Bentley knows or can get back to me. The definition of part-time state resident, I had it in front of me a minute ago.
Part-time?
Part-year resident. Is that something that exists in statute? Is that something we need to put a definition on?
Mr. Bentley.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Keel's question, I don't see that those definitions are not covered in the current definition sections now. Okay. I would have to check and see. I think that the bill speaks to a person's just the wages that are earned in the state is the key factor, whether they're resident or non-resident or whoever they are. If you earn wages in the state, that is the language in the bill.
I think there are definitions, Senator Keel. There are definitions from past legislation as to those specific instances. Any further questions? Senator Keel, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just we would want to make sure that anybody who comes up and works a seasonal job or works a couple on, couple off, doesn't get out of paying this, but we wouldn't want somebody self-employed who's here on a vacation for a week and takes a couple phone calls to owe a return. That's all. I guess a broader question for the sponsor. The amount of money raised by this certainly doesn't handle our deferred maintenance backlogs or even our current maintenance needs. Can you just talk to us about how you settled on this dollar amount? What was the target? What were we after?
Senator Bishop.
We got to start somewhere, and I believe my memory serves me correctly, and that's been 2015. I've had the same number, and I think we ended at 10, and I would have to go back, or you could do it on your gizmo right there, adjusted for inflation. I think that 30 bucks when we did it in 15 was adjusted for inflation from when it was repealed. But I agree with you, it doesn't, right? You see the need. We all see the need. But I would like to say on another point today, and I didn't bring it, I don't believe, and John, you can fact check me here. Today we have about 412,000 wage earners in the state. Is that correct? I believe we have about 412,000 wage earners. Oh, 390,465 employed individuals in the state today. Yeah.
Okay. I want to welcome Senator Hoffman to the committee.
Last one.
Senator Wilson. All right, follow up, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just the last one I had. As I read the language, someone living on a trust fund wouldn't necessarily owe this. Someone living on dividends and interest. Was that a decision made as a tax policy issue, or is that to do with the difficulty of collection?
Senator Bishop.
I didn't factor that in. I was just going off the old bill and revitalizing the territorial intent.
Thank you. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, Senator Bishop. Just have a question here on the physical notes and sort of the structure of this piece of legislation. There are two different notes, one from Department of Labor, the other one from Department of Revenue, and they are vastly different in the assumptions of who would collect the tax and the cost to do that. I think the division in the Department of Labor has maybe, we'll round up to a $2 million existing technology cost, where Revenue has a $10 million cost to collect. And then the personnel difference in the cost is about $200,000 difference between the two. So just wondering, you know, sort of, would it be better to put that all to the Department of Labor to collect? Because it's vastly less expensive, it seems, for having labor to collect that tax than the Department of Revenue. Or have the departments come to you and tell you why there's a huge difference. And if not, we can ask the departments later, the sponsor would like to deflect them.
Got to make a comment, Senator Bishop?
Through the chair, I'd pose that to the departments when the chair wants to cover the fiscal notes, but I don't disagree with you. And having been at labor, that was my original intention I thought and labor could do it cheaper.
Any further questions by members of the committee for the sponsor or his trusty staff? If not, we'll go ahead and go to invited testimony. Maybe let's go ahead and go to the Department of Revenue. Brandon Spanos, the tax director, would you want to come on up and make a few comments? Maybe to go ahead and address some of the questions that were just brought up by Senator Wilson. Please identify yourself for the record and go over the presentation.
So for the record, Acting Director of the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue, Brandon Spanos, and I don't have an actual presentation to give. I'm here to talk about the fiscal note, but I'll address the question through the chair to address Senator Wilson's question on the costs. I can't speak for Department of Labor. I can say we're happy to let anyone else do the work. But as far as in the Department of Revenue, we have a very modern, robust system. In fact, we have, to my knowledge, the most up-to-date tax revenue system of any of the 50 states, and it's something that you can pull out your mobile device and file a return and pay your taxes right from your phone. It's very robust. It does everything that we ask it to do, and that really the legislature has asked for. So as far as reporting, one of the reasons we got this system and that the legislature agreed to pay for it was because the reporting was significantly underwhelming in our previous system. We had several antiquated systems that took months to get reports together, and now we can do it at a click of a button. Well, in most cases, sometimes it still takes some time, but that is the main reason for the cost. The cost is to our contractor. We contract with Fast Enterprises to build our systems. Our current system is a tax revenue management system. It's a newly upgraded system. They call it Core 21. And we have asked them what it would cost to put a new module into that system for this income tax, and that's the price they gave us. So that unless we were wanting to build a separate system, which the Department of Revenue has very strong opinion against doing that, that's the cost to build this module. It is costly, but we are very pleased with the end product. And I think customers, as far as a resident of Alaska that would need to pay an income tax, I'd prefer it to be the simplest type possible. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the IRS's push right now, but they're doing a beta program in 12 different states. Alaska was going to be part of that beta program, but because PFDs issue 1099s, they weren't doing 1099s as part of this beta program, but it's called Free File. So the IRS is doing a push right now to allow everyone to file for free through their website. So you don't have to pay for an outside third-party company to prepare your taxes. If you want to do it on your home computer, you can do it for free if you live in one of those 12 states. And they'll be expanding that to the nation, assuming that Congress continues to fund it. So we have that already here in Alaska for all of our taxpayers. If this tax were to pass and the taxpayer base were to expand to all working Alaskans, then it would be a very simple thing to file. So from that perspective, this would be the preferred model. And we believe we do it well, and we could do it very well, but it does come at a cost.
And Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, let's take the technology aspect out of there. Just the personnel costs seems to be vastly different as well to administer this program between the two departments. It just seems that the Department of Revenue could just learn a thing or two from the Department of Labor on how to have less costs and be more efficient in running their services, Mr. Chair. I just don't see how we have two vastly different notes for a similar service other than the technology aspect, and that taking the vendor out of it, they're still vastly different, and just trying to understand why revenue costs a lot more than labor.
You want to comment, Mr. Spanos?
That is a good question. I appreciate the questions through the chair, Representative Wilson. There is no other state with a comparable tax, so it's difficult to compare. But we did talk to other states and look at as closely similar taxes that we could. Most states have, for an income tax, adjusted for population, around 70 employees for an income tax. And previous notes on other income taxes and sales taxes, our fiscal notes are about 70 employees to administer a tax of that magnitude. We're looking at the taxpayer base and 8 employees to administer a tax for roughly 400 plus thousand people. Not considering the non-residents is a pretty monumental task. If you look at something, a division like the Permanent Fund Division that deals with a similar population base, they have a lot more than 8 people. So we think the 8 is the right number for the tax division. If someone else can do it for less, again, we're happy to let someone else administer the tax. But from our perspective, it's not just collecting $30 per person. There are self-employed individuals that would have to file a tax return and pay that tax. And somebody would have to be there to receive that information, answer questions. You get a lot of phone calls from taxpayers, especially if somebody had several different jobs during the year and had the money withheld several different times. They're going to be calling and they're going to be wanting a refund. And somebody has to answer those phone calls. Somebody has to be processing those refunds. And it just takes personnel.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson. Thank you very much. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that why the difference in revenue estimates between your note and the labor note?
Spanos.
So through the chair, Representative or Senator Keel, I can't speak to labor's note. Our note, we used statistics of income based from the IRS's website to get to the resident number. So we looked at how many taxpayers file with an Alaskan address to the IRS. And we started with that number. Then we worked with Department of Labor to get to a percentage of that number that would be non-residents, and we worked out back in last year when we developed our analysis with them, it was 15%. So we added 15% to that base number that we started with, which again came from the IRS's information, the most recent IRS information, and then we added the $30, or rather multiplied that 30 by that number to get to our revenue estimate.
Follow up, Senator Keel.
Another question, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the fiscal note, is there a typo on FY29 or a great big bump in the services expense 6 years out?
So through the chair, Senator Keel, we did actually submit a new fiscal note because that question came up through the process of getting this scheduled. and we did address that in the narrative. So this systems upgrades are required every several years for modern changes, and that is the system upgrade cost.
Follow up,
Mr. Senator Keel.
That's a system upgrade unique to a head tax module, or is that a proportion of the entire periodic upgrade of your tax system?
So through the chair, Senator Keel, there is no separate cost to one module, but that would be the cost if that was a standalone module. But the cost would apply to the system as a whole.
On up, Senator Keel.
I guess I'm just trying to get clear. Is that a cost we're going to have to pay regardless because we have this cool system, or is that specifically attributable to this bill passing?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the cost, there is no budget for that cost, so we have to come and ask for that upgrade when we get to that point, which we would like to have every several years, but in reality, it's when you're willing to pay for that. With a broad-based tax of this size, we add that cost into the note to just state how much it will actually cost to administer.
Senator Wilson.
I guess I'm a little confused. You said that, say, every 10 years to the module, but we're having this module built for $10 million, and then in 4 years, we're going to have to pay another $7 million to upgrade that?
Mr. Spanos.
So through the chair, Senator Wilson, the cost for the upgrade is as often as we can get it upgraded, and the recommendation from the vendor is every 5 years.
Follow up, Senator Wilson.
And can you state what's the intended revenue? How much revenue is intended to be earned each year?
Mr. Spanos.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the revenue depends on the bill. In this case, the revenue would be, if we look at the first full year of after implementation, it would be $14.3 million.
So every 4 years, we will lose half the anticipated revenue, is what you're stating.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, what I'm stating is there's a cost to the system, and it's not dependent upon the revenue raised.
No, I understand that, but I'm just, I guess, trying to get a better understanding, Mr. Chair, just on if that's the cost, we're going to have to pay that cost when we some sooner or later. And so what I'm saying is that the administrative cost of implementing a system is going to be about half every 4 years of what the current revenue is projected to bring in. Would that be an accurate statement?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, if this is the way that you would like us to administer it, then yes.
Thank you.
I'm not sure that's the way you like to administer. It's more the fact that we don't know what the expenses are going to be. We don't know necessarily what the revenues are going to be. We can project them fairly close, but the expenses just something that's up in the air because hasn't been developed yet. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe I heard it differently. I think I heard that 6 isn't half of 14, but I think I heard that every 4 or 5 years we're going to attribute to this tax the whole cost of upgrading the software that collects all our taxes, which doesn't sound like how we maybe ought to build fiscal notes.
Senator Bishop, you ought to chime in on this?
Senator Keel did a good job because now you've piqued my interest, and I want to see what's that cost to upgrade the system to collect our oil tax revenue, and how much are we going the other way every 4 or 5 or 6 years? Is that the same model on every other TRMS system that we have?
You have a comment, Mr. Spanos?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the original cost of the system. I'm not sure that it was the Department of Revenue. I can speak for the Department of Revenue. We didn't have a plan for upgrading that every several years. I'm not sure we knew that there was going to be a major cost every several years. And so when the original contract, it only had implementation cost, and then it had a one-year service cost. We didn't even have revenue at the time in the budget to pay for ongoing services. So after the initial 5-year contract, there was no way to continue to pay for the services of the vendor to maintain the system. So we've had to come back and ask for that, which you approved. Several years ago, we got the base budget updated to add or to keep or maintain those services of the system. Those in the current governor's budget, there's an additional amount because those service costs have gone up. And so we're asking for an additional amount to continue to maintain the service as it stands. And you also approved in a prior budget one upgrade. So we've had one upgrade since our original rollout. The rollout was 2014, I believe, and that was our original rollout. So now 10 years later, we've upgraded the system one time with an appropriation from the legislature.
Any further comments or questions for Mr. Spanos by members of the committee? Senator Bishop.
I just have a comment. I just like when we're with no malice towards anyone, I just like this referred to as what the bill is written. It's the Education Facilities Maintenance and Construction Tax. It's not an income tax. Thank you.
One question I do have, Senator Bishop, is all the funds that are collected with this, except for the maintenance funds, are they going just to school construction and maintenance?
Yeah, and the university as well.
And the university.
For deferred maintenance, yeah.
Any further questions or comments for Mr. Spanos? No, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon.
Thank you.
Next, from the Department of Labor, Paloma Harbor, who's the Director of the Division of Employment and Training Services. Ms. Harbor, please come on up, identify yourself for the record, and go ahead with your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, Paloma Harbor, Division Director for the Division of Employment and Training Services within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Thank you. I did not have a presentation for the committee. I was here to speak to our fiscal note if there was any questions.
Well, I think what we'd like to know is if you have any comments on the discussion that happened beforehand as to whether the revenue as well as the maintenance costs are going to be as was pointed out.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Yes, for currently the Department of Labor has a mainframe-based tax system for our unemployment insurance tax that we can upgrade or program to collect this additional tax. And it is less expensive, but I would say that our system is outdated. It's on programming language that's, I think, I don't even know how many decades old. And so we are looking into the future to modernize our system. We actually have a capital request in the 25 budget to start the preliminary work towards modernizing our system. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be an expensive project. And so our system is outdated. It's cheaper to program it. But it's harder to maintain. And so, as was spoken to from the previous speaker, they have a modern system in the Department of Revenue that can accommodate this. It does have a cost associated with it, too.
Any further questions or comments by members of the committee? Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Do you know what the ballpark figure is for the modernization of your system for the employment?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I don't have a ballpark. We, like I said, we have a capital request in right now for about $450,000. I can't remember the exact number. Just to do the as-built documentation to say, here's what our programming is at its simplest terms, and then we're going to go out to solicit a potential replacement.
Bob Sanders, Wilson. Thank you. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We trust you'll build in the cost of licensing and periodic upgrades when you come back for the full thing. Can you help me, though, with the difference in the revenue estimates? I see that that in Labor's fiscal note, it looks like about $10 million, including a guess on self-employment. Revenues was $14 million, maybe $14.3 million. Can you talk to us about why that delta in the revenue collection estimate?
Ms. Harbor?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the fiscal note I submitted for the Department of Labor did not include a revenue estimate. And so there shouldn't be one on our fiscal note. We specifically didn't have that updated on our fiscal note.
Correct.
Because revenue had the tax information to do a better estimate on revenue.
Senator Keel.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'll figure out where I got this thing.
Okay.
I believe through the chair that last year the department may have submitted a fiscal note that had a revenue estimate on it, but it was not based on tax data that revenue had.
From the Department of Labor.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, if there's no further questions, thank you very much for coming up this afternoon, Ms. Harbor. Next, we have up the Chief Labor Economist from the Department of Labor, Dan Robinson. Mr. Robinson, please. Identify yourself for the record, and I guess you're going to talk about the workforce estimates and the revenue fiscal note.
For the record, I'm Dan Robinson, Research Chief at the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and my limited role would be to answer any questions about an annual report we put together on resident and non-resident workers in Alaska. It's a statutory requirement, and as Senator Bishop talked about, we also included an abbreviated version in the February issue of Alaska Economic Trends.
So as you look at some of the numbers that Senator Bishop talked about, between 395,000 and 400 and roughly 10,000 workers, is that pretty close to the estimate that your department has come up with as far as workforce numbers go?
Well, the report that we just released is for 2022, and that's because it takes a while for the permanent fund dividend applications to be matched with the wage records. And in that report, we had 316,809 residents and 86,368 non-residents. And a key point there is non-residents are identified by their whether or not they applied for a permanent fund dividend. So that's a rigorous standard for residency. You have to live here for a full calendar year.
Sure. And do you have any, can you comment on what the revenue forecast might be for this bill?
No, other than to say we do discuss lots of things with the Department of Revenue. And we probably for this bill in previous years have talked about self-employment, estimates of non-residents by other definitions. So not specific to the fiscal notes in front of you today, but we do interact with them fairly frequently about worker counts and quite often specific to their relevance to tax revenue potential.
So implementing the new program and the upgrades that need to be involved with that, is it as dismal as they're talking about where half the revenues are going to be put up to upgrade the system and maintain it as it's going to collect?
Yeah, Charles, and I have absolutely no awareness of that issue.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your comments. Any more further questions or comments by members of the committee for Mr. Robinson? If not, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon and being available. Invited testimony now is Dr. Madeline Algillard, the superintendent of Cuspuck School District.
Good afternoon, Chair Olson and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Madeline Algillard. I'm the superintendent of the Cuspuck School District. And thank you for inviting me to speak to Senate Bill number 132. And thank you for the committee for introducing it. Next slide, please. The first I want to look at the Alaska schools by the numbers. As you can see, the number of students that this impacts and the number of school districts, but more specifically, I want to talk about school facilities and the 452 school facilities that exist statewide, which 55% are now greater than 40 years old. Next slide, please. So some of our ongoing challenges with education in Alaska is deferred maintenance. I come from a very small school district, but we have 9 buildings and 7 schools, and this is a topic we deal with every day. And that's because of the growing maintenance needs and the limited state funding. The average building age is 42 years old, and there are 71 buildings that are over 60 years old. The current backlog, as we heard earlier, is over $300 million and growing. Next slide, please. I want to focus really, though, on one specific story, and this story is in complement of other stories. Even in my tiny district, we have multiple schools on the major maintenance list. One that I won't speak to specifically today is actually ranked number 9. However, even at number 9, to get to that project, it would cost over $36 million. The project, though, that I want to speak about today is the Jack Ignaty Senior School in Fleetmead, Alaska. This is a K-12 school, and the building is 45 years old. So it falls into that category that I referenced earlier. There are 17 students in this building, and we're out along the Kuskokwim River, accessible by air or river travel, and our community holds steady at 75 people. Next slide. This school has been on the major maintenance list for 14 years. In 2000, for the FY24 application, we were ranked number 15. That was after an appeal. Our initial ranking was 24th, but we had some serious life and safety concerns. So we appealed, and we went up the list. We were happy. We were hopeful. However, the rankings for the FY25 came out, and we fell. So we are now 23rd on the major maintenance list. However, like I said earlier, there were immediate safety concerns. And so the district, we hired LCG Land Tech to do a structural evaluation. And we've learned that since 2021, the conditions of this building have deteriorated so quickly that we had to close a portion of the building. Next slide, please. This graphic shows just the difference that it made between two school years. So in 2021, we had a condition survey done, and we had that submitted with our application for major maintenance. But then we noticed that conditions continued to deteriorate, and so we had an additional follow-up study done where the architects and the engineers came in and basically said, yes, your conditions have deteriorated, and you are now facing imminent structural failure. This started off as a roof replacement, but it's turning into a roof replacement, a wall replacement, a foundation replacement, and it's growing at an exponential pace. Right now, half of the school building is closed due to the recommendation for imminent safety concerns. You can see the red portion on this graphic shows the part that's closed. There are still students in the active learning areas and staff, which that's just divided by a pantry and a kitchen, but it's still the same physical structure that we are predicting the possibility of an imminent failure. Next slide, please. For rural Alaska and many schools across Alaska, this is even more than just education. There are no other structures in this community that are large enough to even accommodate the 17 students and the staff during the school day. But that also means there are no other structures within this entire community for any physical gathering. Our schools are the lifeline of our communities. These buildings are where our families go to celebrate, where our families go to grieve, where our families go to learn together, where our families spend hours and hours, where students can access emergency needs and supplies. And right now, we aren't able to even provide those assistance. This is one specific example for how this bill would impact the state. And this proposed TED Tax and Senate Bill 132 would help provide a funding solution to the backlog of major maintenance needs for Alaska school districts. I appreciate your time listening today to our specific story, but just please remember that this is also the story of tens and hundreds of other schools across the state, and they're in imminent, dire need of support and a program to help us be able to provide a safe and accessible physical space for our students. Next slide, please. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Dr. Aguilar, are you saying that the gymnasium is closed down because of maintenance issues?
Through the chair, yes. The portion of the building, so half of the school building, the gymnasium, a complete bathroom, the shop, is all closed down. So right now it's the kitchen, the pantry, two classrooms, and one shared toilet that they have access to.
Any further questions by members of the committee for Dr. Aguilar? If not, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon, Dr. Aguilar, and certainly got an uphill struggle ahead of us.
Thank you.
Our next presenter is going to be Kimberly Hankins, the superintendent of LKSD. Ms. Hankins, are you on, ma'am?
Yes, I'm here.
Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Olson and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Kimberly Hankins, and I'm the superintendent of the Lower Kuskokwim School District. I appreciate your time this afternoon to speak to Senate Bill 132. Similar to what we just heard, in LKSD, we have a lot of needs throughout the district, both major maintenance and school construction needs. LKSD is the largest REAA in the state of Alaska, and we do rely heavily on the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development's CIP school construction and major maintenance grant funds to support the needs of the district. LKSD supports Senate Bill 132 and really all efforts to provide additional funding for school major maintenance and construction needs. Attention needs to be paid to the backlog of projects on both lists. Today, I'm just going to briefly go through some of the challenges we're currently facing in the district. Deferred maintenance is at the top of the list. We currently have nearly $14 million of deferred maintenance projects on the FY25 CIP list. And I listed them on the slide for you. I'm sorry, I forgot to say next slide. Can you please advance to slide number 3? Included on the list, you'll note that there is a project for GJE school heating mains replacement. And I wanted to point out to the committee that for many of us, across Alaska, we have to find a way to fund these projects ourselves. For this project in particular, LKSD funded over 5 years ago now the project in order to keep our school open and operating for students, and since that time has sought to be reimbursed for the cost of the project, which was over $1 million, money that we really need in order to put towards students and education in the classroom. Next slide, please. So slide number 4. these photos are from Akyuk Memorial School in Akyuk, and this project is on the deferred maintenance list. It's project number 56. Our gym currently in Akyuk is closed for the second year in a row. Due to some structural issues with the roof trusses, students in our school in Akyuk currently commute to neighboring schools in Agula and Unapacheq to borrow space in their gyms in order to practice for team sports like basketball. Next slide, please. In addition to deferred maintenance challenges, we also have several projects on the school construction list as well. I included this slide on Napakiak. Napakiak is now funded. However, I wanted the committee to be aware that, you know, even with that funding, the new school will take several years to construct and students remain in the existing structure. LKSD has demoed a third of the building. What you're seeing there in the picture on slide 5, this photo was taken during Typhoon Murbach, That is the existing school structure. So we still have students in that part of the facility. And we're really hoping that they can remain in that part of the facility until the new school is completed. You know, I was fortunate to be the principal in Nepakiak back in 2009. And at that time, we were blowing the whistle on the issue of erosion and the need for a new school. And the project sat and sat on the CIP list without receiving funding until it became an emergency situation and then was fully funded in 2021. If erosion does keep pace with what we've seen over the past 2 years, pretty soon we won't be able to use the remaining portion of the school and we'll have to look for alternate locations to provide education services until the new school is complete. Next slide, please, slide six. LKSD has over $167 million of projects on the FY25 school construction grant fund list. Nutak and Muktovic is number one, and we anticipate receiving the rest of the funding for that project shortly. Next slide, please. On slide seven, I included photos from Nutak. So the photo on the left, this is our school in Nutak. The photo on the right shows the demolition project of a water wastewater treatment plant. That project was completed late last summer, and if it had not been, the plant would now actually be in a portion of the river. We still have approximately 30 students in the school itself, and this year we have no running water because we had to demo the water wastewater treatment plant. Students are provided bathroom breaks throughout the school day, and they go home to use the bathroom. And that's how we're making it through this last year of our school being open in Nutak. Again, this is a situation where, you know, we've been sounding the alarm for years about the need for funding for our school in Muktovic. And, you know, currently where that stands is we're working on the foundation project, but we're several years out from having a school facility completed there. Next slide, please. I want to talk briefly about our school in Nunavichuk. Nunavichuk project sits at number four on the school construction CIP list. These photos that I selected show a situation that occurred late last July. We had a ramp collapse at the rear of the building. Unfortunately, the ramp collapsed when we had employees standing on it, and we did have an employee injured due to that collapse. That prompted the district to bring out a structural engineer and do an analysis of the entire foundation of the building. And as a result of that, we have had to close a portion of two classrooms in the school and one additional space in the school entirely. Nunap, one of the reasons Nunap scored points on the application was due to overcrowding, and now we're even more feeling that pinch even more because we're occupying less space due to the foundation issues. So the district is in the position now of having to find money to shore up the foundation of the building while we wait for funding for the new school, the renovation project that we're currently number four on the list for. Next slide, please. Slide nine shows photos from our school in Good News Bay. Again, some foundational issues that we are finding. Good News Bay is currently not even on the list because it costs a lot of money for districts to have condition reports done. And we kind of have to prioritize internally where we're heading next and what classifies as the school most in need for that. So with that, next slide, slide 10, I just wanted to say thank you for your time. Again, LKSD fully supports Senate Bill 132 and any efforts to generate more funding to address the ongoing pressing needs for major maintenance and school construction around the state of Alaska. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Ms. Hankins? Ms. Hankins, I do have one question. One of the questions I have is that how far along is the are the relocation efforts, or what stage are you at on the relocation efforts from Newtok to the new site?
Yes, thank you for that question. And it's hard for me to tell who asked that, so through the chair. In response, we are coming along. We have been working on the foundation portion of the new school in Muktavik. This will be our last year, though, operating the school in Newtok as it currently exists because of the life and safety issue of the river encroaching on the school. We do plan to close the school in Newtok at the end of this school year and demo the building that exists. Most school-age students will be moving, if they haven't already, will be moving to Muktavik for next year. And then we are providing education in the emergency evacuation center in the community.
So are you going to be able to have a facility over there that the kids can go ahead and meet into that's going to be heated and have bathroom facilities?
Yes, currently in the evacuation center in Muktavik, that is what we use as the school currently. And so that will continue to be our space until the school in Muktavik is completed. And yes, it does have that capacity.
Any further questions by members of the committee for Ms. Hankins? Ms. Hankins, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon.
Guyana.
We'll go ahead and open up the floor for public testimony. Anybody in the room have something they want to testify on in this bill? If not, does anybody on the line have anything they want? Anybody want to testify on this bill? Looks like we have nobody else to go ahead and testify on this bill. We'll go ahead and close public testimony. We'll set this bill aside. That concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be tomorrow afternoon at 1:30. We'll be here hearing three bills: Senate Bill 56, the performance scholarships by Senator Dunbar; Senate Bill 141, the naming of Raymond and Esther Conquest, bridged by Senator Hoffman; Senate Bill 24, the mental health education by Senator Gray Jackson. If there's no other business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 2:45 p.m.